You pushed Jews to go back home. Now that they are home, you're trying to eradicate Jews.
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am
with Shai Davidai.
My guest for today is a mystery. Her Instagram bio says the following: Hasbara Unicorn, South African American, trans, Jewish being. Pronouns, let them go. So here I am with Bellamy Bellucci.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. I think the first time we met in person was at a memorial service for the six hostages that were executed on last September 2023. And I meet a lot of people. There was something exciting about meeting you. I don't know why. There's something like you radiate some positivity, some strength, something that was like, I'm glad I met Bellamy. So I start this episode with the question that I start every episode is, Bellamy Bellucci, what kind of a Jew are you?
I think to say that I'm the one that your parents warned you about is an understatement.
You're the Jew that your parents warned you about?
But that's an understatement because okay. I kind of feel as though I'm a bull out of a china shop. I'm everything I'm not supposed to be. And that is the kind of Jew that I am.
So look, we're going to dive right into this. What does it mean to be the Jew that your parents warned you about? Everything that I'm not going to shut up.
And I think for a lot of people, it's about making sure that I can be in, they can make it so uncomfortable for me that I go back into hiding. And it's not going to happen. At any point is it going to happen. And till I take my last breath, I'm the one that's literally going to be in your face till the end.
Have you had people feel like, oh wow, that is the Jew that I was warned about? Have you had those interactions?
Yeah, I've had a lot of those interactions, and I think it's mainly with people that, not just within the tribe, but externally, of being like, it's a lot for them to handle. And I think it goes all the way from just my energy, number one, and then as soon as I open my mouth, it's a different thing. Because everything that they try to use against me is my strength. So if you're going to use something that is racial or gender, or whatever, those are my strengths. That's my life. That's my experience. So I think I know what I'm talking about in that aspect. So you can't sell me on something that I'm not.
So what are you?
A proud Jew. A proud Jew. And I think converting made it so magical for me because there was an awakening that I craved so badly my whole life. So from that point on, why would I go into hiding?
I love that. So I want to get to your conversion story. I want to get to your activism, but I want to set the stage first. Born and raised in South Africa. Yeah. Tell me about your childhood in South Africa.
Colorful childhood, not close with my family at all. And that's because I think there was such a fractured beginning for them already. Apartheid was still being dismantled.
So you were born right at the coattails of apartheid as a black person.
Yeah. Black person living in Alexandria, which is basically another township of which would, if you look at it, whether they built these cities where black people were put into, because then if you dropped a nuke, you could eradicate a whole race. And by the time that I was born, that's where I grew up. So my interaction with even somebody that was a white person was on television. And that was still like, I don't understand what that is. Because from being a very small child, I wasn't in situations of integrating with other people just yet. And it was something so fascinating for me to say, oh, I thought everybody was the same. It made it easy for me to learn multiple languages because everybody was just in this small concentrated space of being, you know, subjected to being completely put into a space and saying, this is actually your life. So I would say when I was very small and naive, everything was beautiful. It was magical. The first few years I was raised by my paternal grandmother, which was very normal. My mother was 18 when she had me. My father was 21. I was a Valentine's Day oopsie baby. But thanks to them, I get to be a screaming brat for the rest of my life. And I went to boarding school at the age of 7
in South Africa
in a different state, because I think my parents wanted to give me an opportunity and the best opportunities that they didn't have. And there was a lot of catching up that I had to do.
So this was after the formal dismantling of apartheid, mm-hmm. but as you say, it was still very segregated.
Yeah.
And we're going to get to anti-Semitism, but before we get to anti-Semitism, I want to talk about racism. What were your experiences with racism?
My experiences
as a kid or teenager?
I would say when I was really young, I didn't see much of it because, again, everybody was the same. But once I got to school, it was a different kind of a thing. And for that point, it was more about the fact that I didn't speak Afrikaans. So the colonizer's language was something that I wasn't versed in. And now I'm learning English and then learning Afrikaans. So there was this hierarchy.
So what's your mother tongue?
My mother tongue is Tswana.
Tswana. And then you learned English, mm-hmm. and then Afrikaans.
And then Afrikaans. Okay. But now I'm in a private school where Afrikaans, it's in a predominantly Afrikaans area, mm-hmm. in Hammanskraal in the Northwest Province. So now there's a hierarchy even within the right race at that time, because the Afrikaans people were the people that were in power. So anybody that was British or English speaking and not Afrikaans speaking was at a second rate before we even get to the black race, before you get to the colored race, anything. Within the white race, there was a hierarchy system. So now I'm in a school where people are speaking in Afrikaans and I'm going, I don't understand what they're talking about. And Afrikaans is a dialect of Dutch, mm-hmm. and some German. So that was, I would say, my first, interaction with racism at that point in time. And my name at the time, my middle name was Johannes. So my first name, Botlhale, which is Tswana, and it translates into wisdom. And then my middle name was Johannes. And the reason why they did it that way is because I'm only supposed to be a gardener or the help. So women were going to be, the biggest profession that a black woman would have is probably maybe a nurse. In a clinic for black people or so forth, but mainly the maid. So you're the help. So Johannes was my name to make it easier for whoever I was going to be employed by to pronounce my name.
Wow.
So already from the get-go, there's an insurance policy to be like, well, this is actually what you're going to do because of your race. So we have to make sure that we can give you a name that when you get your job as the help, they can pronounce.
But then you basically, maybe not just with your mouth, but with your entire body, you kind of broke away by deciding, mm-hmm. I'm going to dance.
Yeah.
So when did you start dancing and, how accepted was that? That I'm going to be a dancer where I'm expected to have like 1, 2, 3, or 4 kind of jobs. And I'm saying, no, I'm doing this other thing.
That was not popular with my mom. So my mother put me into acting at the age of 9. And it was something that was very easy for me. So it was mainly television. I did television voiceovers and a few cameos in movies. So I would go to acting classes on Saturdays and then modeling classes as well. So from a very young age, it was like my schedule was packed in that way. And when other kids were going to school, I would be doing everything on set with a tutor. So I was working from a very young age. And then I don't know what it was about walking by a school, hall and seeing ballet and hearing classical music, that just made me go, I like that. Let me see how that goes. I was dreadful at sports. I could run cross country, flat races, everything great, but it's very seasonal. So in school, when it came to sportsmanship or whatever, I was useless. And soccer, I mean, I'm kicking people's shins. I'm not kicking the ball at all. But also it made it easy for me to hide because of my gender. And it's something that I knew from a very young age. So it was like I needed to be in a place that I could just kind of almost disappear without causing too much commotion, because everything that was happening at home was already too aggressive.
So okay, so spell this out for me a little bit, and I'm sorry if I'm being a bit too...
No.
You know, it's very simple questions, because a lot of people, especially nowadays, are really afraid to talk about anything that has to do with trans. Mm-hmm. And some of them are afraid to say the wrong things. Some of them are ignorant. Some of them are hateful. We have to accept, you know, there's all different kinds. When you think of yourself back 9, 10, 12 years old, boarding school, like you said, there's the hierarchy, the racial, but also the cultural hierarchy. Then there's this extra layer for you, which is you think back to yourself physically, people were seeing a boy. You remember a girl, right? What was that experience like?
The experience was something that I would not wish on anybody. It's not kind. It's definitely not kind. And I think that's why it took me so long to grappling with accepting myself. And because it took me so long to accept myself, I don't seek validation externally. And I think that's very like, oh, but why? From a lot of other people. Even with pronouns, for instance, I think it's something personally for me, Not my thing. Just use my name and we can get along. And if you so choose to want to, hey, what are your pronouns? It'll say she, her, but it's not something that you're going to see in an email or in my, you know, on my social media or anything like that. That's a personal choice. It doesn't mean that I'm anti anything. It's just me. And I think we've reached this point right now, especially with the climate in which we live in, that things are so extreme to a point that if you don't fall in line with the way in which you're told to behave because of what you are, then you're problematic. And for the fact that it took me so long to accept myself, I have an issue with that. Because then, again, you're now trying to put me in a box and enslave me. And that's something that I really don't have time for, because when it's something that you deal with on a daily basis and nobody actually sees what's happening behind closed doors, down to my parents, there's a lot of struggle and self-acceptance, and a lot comes with just walking out the door.
But I want to push back on that a little bit, okay? Because you are probably one of the strongest people out there. And I don't know if you were born strong or had to become strong, because like you said, all of your identities intersecting together create this a problem for the world, and it made you strong. Some people would argue, look, there are trans people out there that are not as strong as you, right? They benefit from this culture of pronouns, this culture of ultra sensitivity. And as long as it's not infringing on anyone's freedoms, then why not? So what would you say like to that?
And I argument? Think that that is a very beautiful thing. And I'm definitely a huge supporter for them and for whatever that means. I think that just because somebody is trans, it doesn't mean that they're not multifaceted. That's where my issue is. So if I'm trans, I have to be in that situation, or I have to be in a vulnerable situation of saying I'm oppressed, or I'm almost victimized because the whole world has to feel so terrible about me. But I also think that within the community, why aren't you looking for people that are strong voices to say, hey, I'm reaching out to you. I want to talk to you. How do you do it? How reach within the community of people that are the exact opposite to you, so that you can actually have and form an iron shield around yourself that whatever is coming at you, you're prepared for. So we're shutting voices out within the community that think differently, have different experiences, because it's something that's different from the cause. And what is the cause? Isn't it the whole thing about liberation? Isn't it about freedom? Why can you not be free and liberated in a space and realize and recognize that, oh, this person is actually different? The one thing that we have in common is the fact that we're trans, but they are different. That is not a whole personality. And by saying that, it's not being controversial. It's just saying, are you questioning everything about yourself, or are you just hanging on to that?
Okay, so I want to get to that, and I wanted to, because like, in order to fully explain the friction within different communities, I first need to fully understand and explain you.
Yeah.
And I want to get, so born in South Africa, when and how did you make it to the United States?
So from doing ballet, I ended up going to National School of the Arts in Johannesburg, which is the largest art school on the whole continent of Africa. It used to have a great reputation. I don't know about now. But then I'm overly ambitious. I've always been overly ambitious, but I think it's because I was running from my own things at home and being trans, like all these things, I was running. So I ended up leaving school and joining a ballet company at the age of 15, South African National Ballet Theatre. And then from there, I was...
Wait. At the age of 15, you dropped school?
Yeah.
Was there any parental pushback?
No, there was parental pushback. And it's because I didn't feel like I was being fed enough. I was hungry. I was too hungry. I was overly ambitious. So instead of traditional academia, which was not traditional as it is, it was an art school. Like, who's doing pliés when other kids are doing, you know, arithmetic? And it was just across the street. So I did homeschooling. I didn't just stop school completely. Uh-huh. I did homeschooling. I continued my education, but that was more of, okay, I know I have to do this. It's just, it's...
But you dedicated, I dedicated yourself to ballet.
To ballet. Completely dedicated myself to ballet. It saved my life. And why I say that is because it gave me purpose, and it was something that I was overly passionate about, so it shut everything else out. And coming from a very abusive family, because I was different, we can, like, they try to run circles around it, but because I was different, because I am who I am, and they knew, they made it very difficult for me. So what I would do is I would fill my days completely. I didn't care which company, which rehearsal, which youth group, and all I did was ballet, and then school. And when I joined the company, again, they started to give me soloist roles, but I'm a teenager. So if that's it, from soloist, I go to principal. What am I going to be a principal at the age of 18, 19, and then what? I'm going to rot, and then I retire. Not enough. So I entered the inaugural South African International Ballet Competition, and I got a scholarship to Dance Theater of Harlem School in New York and Washington School of Ballet. And I opted to go to Washington School of Ballet because of the diversity. I didn't want to be controversial by saying this. I'm going to say it anyway. It's a predominantly Black company, and I didn't want to go somewhere just because of my race. So I wanted to be in a classroom with other people from everywhere and measure myself on what I could do technically, not because of my skin color.
Again, pushing back, and I'm doing it fully out of love, and I hope you know, like, some would say, if you go to the company where you're one of the few Black people, then you're being the tokenized of whatever. They got the Hispanic people, they got the Black people, they got a few Jews, like, versus the tokenization. Whereas when you go to a company that's predominantly dark skin, then it's not because of your race, it's because of who you are. Like,
no, it sounds like a security blanket. For me, in my mind, for me, that sounded like a security blanket, because I'm going to just be part of. that means to me that there's no, I'm not coming in with a question mark of how am I going to inflict change. It's okay for other people to call you a token, but what are you bringing to the table? What is different about you? And for me, it made more sense to be, great, I can be a token of like the one and only South African in there. Fantastic. But what is my dancing coming to? What can I do with that? So if it's going to be tokenized in that way, that's fine. So then my response was, I said to my director, I wanted to do Youth America Grand Prix, the world's largest ballet competition. And he looked at me and he laughed. He was like, that's for the creme de la creme. Like, your technique is really bad. And there are 14-year-olds in the class, and I'm almost supposed to be graduating school, and now I'm supposed to be joining a company. So my ego had to come back. I've been in a company, I've been in a professional environment, but now I'm back in school. So fall in line. And what I did with that was, instead of complaining or crying about it, I cried. I mean, it was painful. But I would wake up at 5 a.m. in the morning, go to yoga. From yoga, I would go and take class first thing in the morning. I would work the front desk to earn my stipend. I would take a full day of class within my own level. And then when everybody left, I would go and take class with the babies to restart my body again. Because somebody looked at me that I look up to and said, laughed in my face and said, yeah, it's never going to happen. Within less than 4 months, they came to me and asked me, we want to send you to the competition.
And what happened?
I didn't do well regionally, but I made it because of my scoring to New York for the finals. And I ended up placing 5th out of the top 12 men in the world. So these are people that are now in the major companies in the world as principal dancers or running their own companies. That was my reward.
I want to point something out. Back then, you were dancing and competing as a man.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you still dance?
No.
You no longer dance?
No.
So when you were competing as a man, was it a different experience than dancing as a woman?
It was a completely different experience because it's something that never felt natural to do, you know, be so focused on a bravura style and everything when I just wanted to be like, okay, great. Let me see how like my lines are, like more feminine, softer. But the best thing for me is that I have really short Achilles tendons. And what that gave me is one of the highest jumps. So in a way, it helped. It helped. And it helped me hide so I could figure out what I was doing. It was not the best situation. It was very uncomfortable. Every single day was very uncomfortable because I just felt like I'm being pushed to be something that I'm not. But then again, everyone's in tights. So what's the big deal?
Everyone's in tights. Everyone? I love that. That should be your t-shirt. Everyone's in tights. What's the big deal? I love that. So, and then, before we get to maybe like the biggest change, which people might say is the transition, and I don't think that's the biggest change, but you identify, which is what you are, as a South African American. Mm-hmm. Break that apart for me, right? Because we have the African American as a large category, and obviously there's many different versions of African American versus Caribbean African American. What is it to be a South African American, and why do you add that qualifier?
Because first and foremost, I am South African, and I've had a lot of conversations with people about that term African American, because for me it's so polarizing. It goes beyond race. So if I look at somebody and they're like, as an African American, I was like, no, you're a Black American. You're a Black American. But no, I identify. That's okay. That's fine. It is fine because of what we know historically and that search for, okay, this is where our people came from. But for it to be this defining factor of I am African American is like, that's lovely. But there's this thing about South Africans that I don't think like a lot of people know, and those that do will understand. South Africans love to completely separate themselves. When people are like, in Africa, we're like, no, South Africa. There is a huge difference. Besides the fact that it's 54 countries, I think we need to be more respectful of the fact that it's not just Africa. You know, I don't live in the Americas. I live in the United States of America. So the South African part for me is that having walked away from it by choice, to the point that I even stepped away and gave my passport away, my citizenship, when I didn't have to, is important to me. And people love to say, we don't claim you. You are not one of us. You don't get to make that choice for me. So I am a South African American.
And then you're something else. You are a Jew.
Mm-hmm.
And you converted.
Yeah.
You told me that you finalized the conversion in 2018. 18. But when did the process start? Like, when was the first time that you felt, I am a Jew, I want to be a Jew, I need to be a Jew, whatever it was inside of you?
I think the question started for me when I was 10 years old, because I was raised in a Methodist family. And down to the point was like my family was on the church board. So everything was centered around Christianity, Christianity, Christianity. And I hated not, I think, I don't know, maybe I was just born to ask questions. And I think the fact that I was answered with because was not good enough for me. And there was this sense of fear about, oh, I didn't kneel at the foot of my bed to say a prayer and ask for something. Oh, I ate something and I didn't. But why? Because. So living in a state of fear when I already have an extremely abusive mother and father, I don't need more fear in my life. I'm terrified enough as it is. I'm running on PTSD. I don't need to feel that way about God, because if God truly loves me, then why am I so petrified of God? So I stepped away from it, and also being in the ballet community, a majority of my friends were Jewish. So when I would have really hard times at home
in South Africa,
when I would have really difficult times at home, or I had rehearsal, it was like, no, come stay with us. And then it was Shabbat. And I was like, wait, you actually sit down with your family, and you might not like so-and-so, but you actually sit down with them and you unwind. It was like, yeah. I was like, that makes no sense. Like, what is that? But there was such a sense of light and community that I slowly but surely started to see. And I was like going, okay, I need to take a step back from Christianity, but just from religion, because I need to question things. There's something missing spiritually. There is a spiritual aspect and a disconnect completely. So I did the whole chanting thing. I did Nam-myoho-renge. I searched and I kept coming back.
What's the whole chanting thing?
Nam-myoho-renge-kyo. I was a Buddhist for a short space of time. I was, you know, I'd be on tour at some point and I'd have to like get my friend to leave the room so that I can chant, because I was too annoying for them at some point. So I kept searching, but it wasn't a decision that I was going to make lightly. But that's when I first started going, something's off, because why do I feel like I align with Judaism more than I do Christianity? And every time that I would ask questions within the Jewish faith with people that are Jews, they welcomed the question. And even if they didn't know, they were like, but why do you want to ask that? Why do you want to know that? I was like, oh, I can talk. You're telling me that it's not like definite, like this is what it is. I was like, okay, that's strange. But I would say when I went to the Kotel in 2011.
Kotel is the West Wall. Western Wall. For people, which just for people maybe listening or watching and don't exactly know, it's the remnant of the outer fence wall of the Second Temple. And that is where it's considered the holiest site for Jews, and that's where Jews in Jerusalem go to pray.
Go to pray, yeah. And I was on tour in Israel, and we took a day and we went to Jerusalem and we went to the Kotel, and I was sobbing uncontrollably, couldn't understand why, but it wasn't a fearful thing. It almost felt like a rebirth, but it didn't make sense. And then I remembered, oh, I've been trying to figure this out for years. But then it was almost like a nod. It was like, mm-hmm, great, you're ready. So then I came back to the US and I started to immerse myself more and do more research. So going to different shuls, speaking to different rabbis, joining into conversations, trying to find community in that way. And then I started going to Congregation Beit Simcha Torah, CBST. And it's in New York, so like 30th Street or something like that. And my rabbi at the time was Sharon Kleinbaum, the, you know, LGBTQ plus. It used to be on Bethune Street as well. So I was like, okay, great. So I can be me. That's great. And I told my friend in South Africa, I was like, but so my rabbi, she, and he was like, what do you mean she? What are you talking about, she?
Is your Jewish friend.
My Jewish friend. but it was nice to kind of have that banter and going back and forth. And the more that he started to learn about my community, even with live streaming when I was in South Africa, was like, oh, okay. Slowly but surely was like, oh, you do things differently over there. Because it's like pretty orthodox in South Africa. Even if you're modern orthodox, they're pretty like, no, men are here. Women are here. Don't do that. But it opened his eyes up more. And then I ended up finding a rabbi, Charles Simon, who's Masorti, so a conservative rabbi, because reform just didn't make sense for me. You know, it's like it's somebody going for a baptism or something. Hi, I want to be Christian. It's like, welcome. It was too, for me personally.
It didn't touch you in the way it didn't, that other things touched you. For me, it's not about making sense or not. Yeah. It's because I'm also an atheist, like, in a way, none of it makes sense for me, but then I understand that making sense is not the point. It's about the connection and whatever you feel comfortable connected to.
So yeah, that made more sense for me. And I worked one-on-one with him, so I didn't do traditional classes or anything. And I was on the road, you know, 8 months of the year because I worked for a touring company. So whenever I saw him, it was stacked with books. This is what I need on this day. Where's your tour schedule? So it would get like an email to say, okay, great, I'm going to be in the UK for 2 months. And we would go city by city by city. You're going to go to this shul, you're going to go to this shul, every single time. So I never felt as though I was so disconnected, but then I also could live stream services from New York with the community that I have here. And it made it easy for me to integrate it into my life. And everything was an open-ended question with him. Like, well, what do you think this, what do you think you need to do in your life? And I was like, I don't know, maybe I love to cook. So I was like, I don't know what I'm doing. So I would separate my kitchen and be like, great, that's for the roommates. This is for me. And I started bringing food into a daily thing of going, oh, maybe I'll make my own challah instead of going to Zabar's or something and getting a challah. I'll learn to braid my own challah, because then what does it mean to me? What is braiding challah? What is, you know, praying? And that's how I think I found my way into really integrating it for me in my life and giving it meaning.
So you became officially, I mean, and this is where it's difficult to talk about. Jews don't talk about converts in the way that other religions talk about converts, because you don't become Jewish. The tradition in Judaism is that your soul has always been Jewish, and now you are in practice a Jew. But like the idea of, you know, it's a nice tradition, but I believe it, even if you don't believe the tradition itself, is that all Jewish souls were on Mount Sinai, right? But to the world, you became Jewish in 2018. Mm-hmm. October 7th, 2023 happens. I know what it feels like for an Israeli Jew like myself. I know what it feels like for non-Israeli Jews, because I'm in the diaspora. What does it feel like What did it feel like for a convert?
Okay. It was a very strange out-of-body experience. I was at dinner. I was in Seattle visiting one of my friends that I grew up with in South Africa. We went to school together, and she lives here now. And I remember being at dinner and getting the red alerts because I've had the app for years now. And I think especially after...
Why did you have the app for years? Do you have family in Israel?
No.
By the way, the app, for people to know, is an app that tells every Israeli and many Jews around the world that have it when a rocket is headed towards Israel, which is, I don't think any other country has an app. Like, you have an app. People have apps on their phone for cameras, for fun. We have an app that tells us rockets are coming, going to bomb shelters. Yeah.
So I think it was May of 2021 when everybody was in lockdown of what I refer to as Hamas having their dress rehearsal for October 7th. A lot of people were quiet about it. So I learned about it then, and I was still very active. On social media, vocally, and especially on TikTok at the time. And the conversation was like, is this another intifada? Like, is this what they're trying to do? And I was also sharing about my journey as a convert and what Judaism is to me on a daily basis, whether I was cooking, and like, I did all of these things. And that was a conversation. So that's how I got the app. And I never got rid of it. And the alerts kept coming in, but there was something so unsettling because I was like, this is not like any other time. There's something very strange happening. And I said to my friend, I'm in Seattle, as though like I'm a crazy person. I was like, we have to leave. And she's like, what do you mean? It's like, no, we have to go. I need to be indoors, safe in the house, because I don't want anybody listening to me or hearing anything that I have to say, because I was like, okay, now I need to check on my friends that are in Israel, because there's something off. There's something very, I couldn't sleep. And then slowly but surely, I was like getting messages. They're like, no, there's something very strange happening. There's something very strange. It's something that feels, and this is before people were being told or any videos. It was just like, there's something off completely. And for the little bit of sleep that I had, I remember waking up the following day and just going through my phone. And the first thing that I wanted to do was to be in Israel. I felt so removed and helpless because we're a very small population of people as Jews, diaspora and in Israel, a very small population. And to think that something like that is going on, just like I explained to you in South Africa with the township, is if you drop something, you can eradicate. So for me, it was like this alarm system going off in my spine, going, there's something happening, there's something happening, there's something happening, and they won't stop. And I just got on my phone and I just started talking about it because I was so sick and tired of being quiet. I stepped away from social media for a while, like for years. I deleted TikTok. And at the time, I think I had like 73,800 people. And I stepped away from it because it was too toxic for me. And I had been told so many times, yeah, you can't be, you know, like wearing a Star of David or a Chai, whatever, like just put it inside. Nobody needs to see that. Nobody needs to hear what you were. It's enough.
And I've seen I've heard a quote of you where you say, I didn't convert to Judaism to hide my identity, which I thought was really, really strong, because you made an active choice and now you're being told to hide your active choice. Mm-hmm. But the flip side of that, and I have to ask, is many Jews and Israelis, like, this was thrust upon us, right? And we wish it wasn't, this whole war, this whole wave of anti-Semitism around the world. Has the thought ever crossed your mind of like, why did I convert? Why do I need this? Why do I need to be the target if you could have chosen not to?
The truth of the matter to that answer is that I would be dead. Because I honestly don't feel that I would be able to live with myself. Because again, it's not about hiding myself to the outside. It's denying myself who I am internally. So I can't live or continue my life if I'm in a state of I don't feel like myself. I can't be myself to myself.
You know, as you're saying this, I was just thinking, if we just took this 15-second clip of you saying that, and we don't tell people what you were talking about, you could have been talking about being Jewish and facing anti-Semitism, and you could have been talking about being trans and facing transphobia. For you, it seems like you've always been a Black Jewish woman. Just the world didn't know.
Yeah.
So you felt like you have to speak up.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. Do you remember? I looked at, you have a post from December 31st, 2023. And I don't know if the date is meaningful in some way. Do you remember this post?
No.
So... It's the last day of 2023, and up until that point, on at least your Instagram, it's very much you dancing, you modeling, you hanging out, beautiful pictures. You never hide your Magen David. You never hide, you know, your Jewish symbols, but it's not front and center. But then on December 31st. You post this thing, but from my perspective, is your first real activist post.
Yeah.
And it starts with, I won't apologize for who I am. What led you to that point?
At that point in time, I was in LA, and I was dealing with a lot that was going on in the modeling industry, and being manipulated in a way of being like, you're an empath and you can't save the world though. And what's happening in the Middle East is something that you should probably just leave to the people. So it was this whole psychological thing of like, oh, this is how we need to speak to her. So that like, we know you care, but you should probably just
Just to be clear, just so I know, because I don't want to make wrong assumptions, are there people speaking out about the quote-unquote other side? I don't really believe there are sides here, but about the Hamas, Hezbollah, and are told the same thing?
No.
Or is everyone quiet? What's going on in the modeling world?
Everybody that was anti-Israel, everybody that was, you know, a watermelon in a bio and being like, you know, Zionists are this and blah, blah. They were fine. They were fine. There are no deals being lost. They're fine.
So it's not about don't speak about something so far away that you have no impact on. No. It's don't speak about this side of this thing that's happening far away.
Yeah. And at that point in time, I had reached, I think I was just so tired. I was just so tired. And now I remember that you've said that. And I remember saying, I had lost everything. I have nothing left to lose. So
what did you lose?
My career. It was not just from the dance world shut me out prior to that already. And then in the modeling world, when I'm trying to reinvent myself and go into something else, and like I've medically transitioned now and I'm like working on myself. Okay, let's do this. Like gung ho, do you. And all of a sudden it's like, no, we're going to like thrust you into such a state of poverty that you will not be able to do anything. So it's like, that's how we're going to make sure that you fall in line. And that was something that I wasn't willing to do. I understood exactly what was happening and the level of manipulation that it takes to get to a point where I can be like, okay, we're going to break you down so much And then when you realize that you are literally so desolate, then you're going to go, okay, good. I'll shut up. I'll remove everything. I'll do this. I'll do that. I'll fall in line. And that was my biggest issue. Because...
So they just wanted you to be a pretty face.
Yeah. Which is lovely. And it's like, oh, you post
and
about
by
your
way,
food.
You have a pretty face. So and it's not, you know, but it's... That shouldn't be the one thing.
The one thing. And it's great to take a picture, but I could keep like, it's lovely. I'm so happy for people that that's all that they need to do. I think it's amazing. But to dictate to me how I need to present myself in that way by making me feel as though there's something wrong with me is problematic. I don't need to be diagnosed by somebody that doesn't know what it's like to be a Jew. Do not do that. And then there are people even within the community that I understand they can't speak out. They can't be overly open because there is a fear. There's a history of what's been done in terms of Jewish prosecution for so long that I definitely understand that. It's just that my experience is completely different. Like you said, from a quote of mine before, it was like, I didn't convert so that I could hide my identity. It's null and void for me at that point in time because then I've betrayed myself.
But there is a spectrum between hiding and being so vocal. Like you could have chosen somewhere in the middle, which, by the way, most Jews, converts and non-converts, choose, which is, you know, I'm Jewish, I'm not going to hide my Jewishness, but I'm also not going to speak up. Why are you speaking up?
How is it that in this day and age, you can go into someone's house, not just threaten their life, take their lives in such a barbaric way, and then take a step back and say, I'm the victim? And we're supposed to believe that that's a reality? And historically, pogroms and everything else, you pushed Jews to go back home. Now that they are home, you're trying to eradicate Jews from, like, that's why it's important for me because, again, very small population of people. And if that's the only thing that I ever do in my life, let me do it with my whole chest. So it's not about it being like, oh, it's you're a poster of this. I've heard people say everything from the most horrendous things. I've had the death threats. I've got great, fantastic, don't miss. I don't know what, you know, what they want from me, but they're not going to get it in that way. You cannot take Israel away because it's the only place that feels like what is home to me. So it has something that is very personal to me. So if that's what you want to do, good luck. And unfortunately, yeah, it's an unpopular opinion. I could care less. And the only way for me to do it was to be that loud and is to be that vocal. Because being in a bus in Trafalgar Square in 2018 and seeing people chant to globalize the Intifada back then, and not being able to get off the bus because of looking around going, there's something very wrong in the world because this is not okay. The anti-Semitism has always been there. It's now just been given a complete platform. And you can't have any pushback on that? That's not reality.
What happens when people, you confront people with reality? You confront people with, you know, just by being you. You said, you know, earlier we were talking, just by breathing in the room, without mm-hmm. even speaking, you know, they come calling Jews white colonizers. And then they are faced with you. They come and shout apartheid. And then they're faced with you, who your family lived through apartheid and you lived through the consequences of apartheid. What happened then? People's minds, what are the interactions like? Because I can be honest with you, like, I am from the land of Israel, 2000 something years ago, as a Jew, I am from Judea. And not but, and for hundreds of years, my family was mostly Eastern European. That is why my skin is relatively light-skinned. That's why I pass as white. But then when I go and someone shouts white colonizer, we get into this useless argument. Mm-hmm. Because I can explain, I am not white. You don't get to define me as white. But I look white. So they don't care. I can explain that it's not colonization. It's a decolonization project. But the fact of the matter that my grandfather was born in Haifa under British rule, but my great-grandfather came to the Ottoman Empire from Europe. So for me, it's always like it's going to hit that wall. What happens when you are faced with those arguments? You don't look like a white colonizer or someone who, an oppressor in an apartheid regime.
People buffer. They literally buffer. They don't know. They don't, because whatever it is that they're saying is a complete and utter lie. When you confront people and say what you're saying is a lie, instead of accepting it or being open to having a conversation, what they're going to do then is go into a state of wanting to attack. So instead of taking a step back and listening or questioning what it is that you've been fed as opposed to the truth, you're going to go on attack. Because again, everything has been happening for so long to the point that people genuinely believe all the libels. And to them, that's the state of reality that they live in. So for me, if you're really going to confront me, you have to be willing to listen, but question. Don't attack. There's no point. There's really no point in attacking because, again, you're literally facing the truth. All you need to do is just look at me. And if you can't face the truth in that way, it means that you can't even take accountability for your own life. You can't take accountability for your own actions. So there's something clearly off with you. So you need to take stock of your own life. You cannot blame everybody, and you can no longer blame Jews for everything that is wrong in your own personal life.
Can I just take you and bring you to Columbia University and speak to everyone? I have to tell you, for the past 14 months since everything started, I keep trying to put myself in the other side's shoes. Yeah. And when I say the other side, it's not Palestinians. It's not even Hamas. That I understand. That is something that is painful, but I understand. What I don't understand is the American, mostly white students in Ivy League schools, meaning that their parents come from very wealthy families, unable to face. And like you said, when they meet you, is literally face the truth. That is something that I cannot understand.
And it comes from a system that has bred people that way. You need to feel, because you're to blame for everything that's happened. You're to blame for slavery. You're, because of being a white man, or being just the fact that you are white, you are the problem. Everything that is wrong in America and in the world is because of white people. Okay, congratulations. Now moving forward, what are you going to do with it? Oh, I'm going to be extremely guilty and become a social justice warrior so that I can feel better about myself for saying that I stood up for something. But what do you stand for? They can't answer it.
But can you explain this to me? Maybe you don't, because I don't think it's explainable.
Yeah.
Because this is where, I guess, your multifaceted identity comes into play. In our world that is dominated by this progressive language, which in many instances can be very good and positive, in other instances can be stifling of free speech. And but we need to see both positive and negative. There is this argument, this idea, that if you identify as a woman, you present yourself as a woman, then you are A, woman, and B, to be referred to as a woman, right? And that's your experience mm-hmm. as a trans woman. But there's also this other idea that if you identify as a Jew, then you don't get to decide, because if you pass as white, then you are white. If you identify, you know, you're a Mizrahi Jew, a Yemenite Jew, and you are indigenous to the Middle East, then no, you're not. How do people in these spaces reconcile the two? That I have to accept your identity for who you are when it comes to gender, sexual orientation, all things that are important, but not in this other thing when it comes to Jews.
I'll say one thing before I go into that. It bothers people when I say I'm a trans woman. It bothers them that I leave that trans part there. Because again, their fight is trans women are women. Fantastic. Great. I'm a trans woman. I am not going to go ahead and call a woman a birthing person. Or that's fine. I understand where people are coming from, but they don't want to. If they don't want to respect that for me, there's no way that they're going to explain everything else. Again, fall in line, put something in a box, and this is exactly what you're going to be, because we are telling you that it's that way. And I saw a trend happening with cancel culture. And before we got to cancel culture, we had political correctness in terms of how you speak. I'm not talking about politics. I'm saying the correctness of speech. So if you are going to police speech in that way, there is no longer free speech. And with that being said, something can be taken so far that it becomes stifling. We have gone so far in one direction in overly correcting something that in a way we've just reached the same place that we were before. So they will not understand, and they will refuse to understand, because it's okay to identify and do whatever it is that you feel like. That's fine, because again, there is a lack of accountability when it comes to dealing with self. So you cannot come to any conclusion with somebody or any kind of understanding for them to see your side as a Jew, because all that they're going to do is a constant pushback, because it all boils down to the fact that they are just anti-Jewish racists. That is it. But calling somebody that becomes problematic. When I moved to this country, I was told black people can't be racist. I said, there's no such thing. No. We're taught in school that black people cannot be racist. What is racism? They can't define it. So if you really boil it down to the most basic within just language, we've lost the plot. You cannot make sense with these people in that way.
There's so many things. I'm looking at the clock and I say, like, we have to end really soon. And there's one more question that I want to ask. There's a million more questions that I want to ask. But one more question. You first converted and then medically transitioned. Even though, as we talked before, since you've been four, I believe you identified as a woman, to yourself, and since you were 10, you were enchanted, started your path with your Jewish identity. But you converted as a man, and you said you converted as Boaz,
mm-hmm.
and then you went to the mikveh again as Shoshana, right? And because this is a Jewish civil rights podcast, it's not just about us to the world, but also civil rights inside of us.
Mm-hmm.
What's the experience been like as a South African American black trans woman in the Jewish community? I'm sure it's not always accepting. It's not. What has it been like?
What I love about the Jewish community is that it's not something that's supposedly a utopia. And I think a lot of people tend to think that that's, I'm like, yeah, and they're like, oh, it's so beautiful. But then there's, no, no, no. The fact that there is so many different avenues of like, well, maybe, maybe not, but then there's this, but then that for me is beautiful. It's conversation. There's that means that people's brains are moving. That means that people are actually questioning their own education prior, as because then to see something and be like, no, this is what I believe, I see it on paper, but then to also see somebody in real life and be like, oh, okay, pause, what is okay? I think that's fine. That to me means that there is progress happening with humanity. If we weren't in a place to have those questions, or for me to even have the other side that could be negative and saying, oh, no, 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 there's no such thing as that. No, no, there's no, I don't think, again, it's for me, it's breath. It's.
But do you feel welcome?
Absolutely.
I mean, let me be honest. I don't feel welcome in every Jewish mm-hmm. community. Like there's some ultra, ultra Orthodox communities where it would see you with high tattoos and be like, yeah, I don't know, like, is this guy Jewish? Is he not Jewish?
Yeah.
Do you have that experience? And you're walking into a synagogue, you're on tour, and we're like, who is this black woman? Why is she here?
Oh, no, from day one. From day one, even before converting, there was always, it's questions. And then it breeds whispers within yourself. It's like there's constantly just whispers in your head. So it is a way, again, one needing to accept themselves, because then whatever you're hit with at that point in time is something that you can have a conversation with or step away from. People are people at the end of the day. It doesn't matter Jewish, what, people are people. But I definitely feel more accepted within the Jewish community, because if we really want to talk about diversity, even take the trans out, the most diverse people in the world are Jews.
I've made that argument, and I made it logical argument, because anyone can be Jewish if they just go through the process, meaning that it's by definition through the process, it is diverse. But when I say it, I'm a white passing heterosexual cisgender male, which I acknowledge. Those are what the world sees, even though I'm not white, I'm all the other things. It's hard for me to make that sell, but when you say it, how does it not hit differently in people listening?
I don't know. I don't know. I think the biggest mistake that people made historically, thousands of years ago, was making sure that Jews spread throughout the world, diversified, and then came back home. The biggest mistake, it was their biggest failure, because to say the something like that, to the anti-Semite, yeah. It was their biggest failure, because then to turn around and say things like that, it's like, you're really not a full stack of cards there.
You made us strong. You made us who we are.
Exactly.
And now we're here, and you got to deal with what you did.
Congrats.
All right. So I like finishing up every episode with what I've been calling the Jewish lightning round. It's a series of quick questions and answers. There's no right or wrong answers. Just give me the first answer that comes to mind. You get one pass, but I get to decide if you get that pass.
Okay.
So I'm not going to be easy on you. Okay. Bellamy Bellucci, what is one thing people don't know about you?
I'm very domesticated.
Domesticated? What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
The most enlightened people.
What is your favorite curse? You know many languages, so whatever language.
Klafte.
Klafte? It's in Yiddish. Okay, explain. People watching on YouTube might be getting this as more of the experience. Like you're listening on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you are. To have a South African American trans woman saying klafte as your favorite curse. Yes.
My friend's grandmother, I learned it from my friend's grandmother when I was in South Africa very young, because it was a lot of Yiddish in South Africa, actually. Like oi was one of the first things. I didn't know that it was even Yiddish. I just thought it was like a slang word in South Africa. I was just like, oi vey, like things like that. But klafte is something that I heard from my friend's grandmother. They're survivors from Lithuania. And it was one of the favorite things. She had this stern look on her face, and you would just, out of nowhere, she silent and wouldn't say a thing, and people would just press. And then when she fully exploded, it would, that was the one thing that would come out of her mouth, and you better run, because that's it. Like, she's reached her boiling point, and most people never came anywhere near her after that, because you would leave sobbing. And obviously, like, it's towards other women, but it's just like she was done.
Klafte is like low grade bitch. Mm-hmm. When was the last time you cried?
This morning.
You want to tell me what about? Sorry.
Understanding that I need to trust the process, and I failed myself because, like, I do this bitachon practice on a daily basis where I just like listen to it as a study. And I've been so overwhelmed with so many things. So this morning I checked in and I just started sobbing. So, yeah.
If you could have any person over for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, who would that be?
Joan Rivers.
Joan Rivers?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Again, like, I'm sorry. This is supposed to be the lightning round, but you're hitting them like, okay, why Joan Rivers?
Her comedy got me through some of the darkest days. And I think her resilience is something that I have I've looked up to her as just that person that no matter what happened and how life knocked her down, her husband's suicide, losing her television show, like all the things, a fractured relationship with Melissa when she was younger and how they healed together. And she's everything. She's everything to me.
What's your favorite Jewish holiday?
Pesach.
What's your least favorite Jewish holiday?
I don't have an answer for that one. I don't know.
When do you feel safest?
When I can fully take the mask off.
When do you feel least safe?
Most of the time. Most of the time. Daily, I would say.
What gives you hope?
Knowing that I'm living out exactly what my soul's intent was in coming back.
What is the first thing that comes to mind when you think of the words Jewish civil rights?
Making sure that change takes complete and utter. Making sure that the change comes to light. That was a heavy one.
That was a tough one. I could see it in your eyes. Finally, every episode, I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel or across the Jewish diaspora. Where would you want listeners to donate to this week?
Israel Friends US.
Israel Friends US. What do they do?
They've been really great in helping the IDF and making sure that they have everything that they do in terms of technology and also with dealing with mental health and PTSD.
Bellamy, where can people find you? Not addresses.
Okay, we're
on social media.
On Instagram, Bellamy Bellucci.
Can you spell it out for people?
BellamyBellucci.
Your Instagram bio says that you're a Hasbara unicorn. Look, I don't know if you're Hasbara, not Hasbara. I think you are just a unicorn. And I say that in the most positive way. I'd even say you're more of a unicorn. You're a narwhal than unicorns of the sea, because unicorns have become so, like, everyone uses that now. I am so grateful for you for being here, for having this conversation with me. I want to keep having more conversations with you, and just happy to say here I am with Bellamy Bellucci.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at The Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."